Let's now try to deconstruct a little bit what you've been saying. I think there is a theme here about sort of understanding what lies behind what you see. What are the tacit assumptions and mechanisms and so on? But we'll discuss more of this. I would now like to invite all of you, presenters, and also Gunn and Magnus, who will give some brief comments on the four presentations. And then I'll pass the word to Magnus. Okay, please.
Okay, thank you, Eva. And thank you, presenters, for really interesting papers, research, and presentations. It's been a real privilege to read them, a real challenge also, I would say. I will give very brief comments on each of your papers, and then identify some common themes that I think they touch upon and that I find to be important for development cooperation, and development, I should say. I begin with Yumiko. I think that the research presented illustrates very well how a variety of institutions of different kinds, exemplified in the presentation, what kind of formal and informal rules that are in play, how they interact in shaping constraints and opportunities for local NGOs' abilities to act, and thus how they influence their adapted strategies for advocacy. And it's interesting to note, for example, which comes out very clear, how informal rules tend, or at least often, take precedence over informal rules. And from a donor perspective, this is doesn't come as news, but it's something I would argue that we very often disregard in our work. We don't know how to deal with informal rules. And I think that your research is relevant from different perspectives, obviously for the role, the nature and interaction of institutions, but also for conditions and practices of NGOs. I guess your work would be useful for NGOs in analyzing their context and adapting their strategies to that. Also for donors supporting them, of course. That's also far for you. Arvid? Hi. Thank you. New area, psychology, still relevant for us. I read it with great interest. You already, as regards the relevance for development cooperation organizations, you already discussed that quite a lot. I won't go through that, but I think that the points you made are very valid, agree that this really can be useful for us as donor organizations to better understand the basis for our decisions, and that will. Becoming aware, as you say, could help us to for instance, not when we decide which projects to support, and so not be carried away by our emotions, which may not be appropriate for our organization. And you come across that kind of dilemmas sometimes. So I would like to add one thing, which was my first reaction when I read about this and how I thought that this could be useful in addition to what you bring up, and that would be for aid organizations and NGOs, for instance, could use your conclusions or findings in their way of attracting support as well as legitimacy by appealing to different motives of different actors. And I was wondering whether it could be useful for your NGOs in the Mekong River Delta also, Maybe they could use those findings in their design of advocacy strategies adapted to different target stakeholders, for instance. So that's my comment on that one. Then Elin. Hello. Really interesting. We talked a little bit before the seminar started. I mean, you managed to make clear, I think, in your draft, the very essence of your findings. It was easy to follow. Very interesting. I all find them relevant for our work in different ways. Let me just say that I think these four papers, they are highly relevant for development and development cooperation in at least six areas. The role of institutions, income diversification, rural development, poverty reduction, gender equality and women's economic empowerment, and children's school attendance. I will not give comments to all your papers. I just want to make a small comment on one of them. It could have been on any of them, actually. When you discuss how women's income diversification differs from men and that they rely more on own farming and less on off-farm wage labor, and then you suggest that one explanation for that may be that they face severe constraints to enter the labor market in terms of education and gender norms, or at least more constraints than men. And the policy recommendation is sort of to reduce these constraints, and that's I don't have so much to say about that. I just would like to draw attention to the circumstance that women also face more severe constraints than men, at least in sub-Saharan Africa, when it comes to how they can do their farming to make farming income generating. And they face more severe constraints, but similar constraints than as men, for instance, when it comes to farm inputs and credit. But they also face gender-specific constraints in terms of land rights, for instance, and also gender rules. That's for you. And Montserrat, I found your paper most intriguing and most challenging. The topics are very close to my heart, but I found it most difficult to understand. It's rather theoretical, and you sort of forward your argument, and as a donor, my time is limited. But you clarified some things during the presentation. So maybe if I try to interpret what you said, that will be my comment to you, if that is correct. And what I think you are saying is that factor endowments, not colonialization or colonial rules, help to explain why the south of Vietnam managed to better benefit from recent reforms, from Doi Moi, better than the north, because of differences in factor endowments. And if I don't know if this is correct, but I understand that you are saying that the different factor endowments contributed to shaping different local institutions, and it's the interaction between those local institutions and the factor endowments that shape the path of development, economic development over time. And that sort of, and so that the differences may to some extent between the South and North be self-reinforcing. I don't know. I think that is very interesting. I would like to know more about it. It has a lot of implications for development and development cooperation. I think your research, but also the research of the rest of you, are relevant in a number of different ways. There are some, first of all, I would like to say that several of you have done case studies, country cases, among other things. And I would say that they are often, can often be highly relevant for the specific context. Of course, you can learn something also, although you cannot for certain, you don't know how to what extent they are generalizable, but you can learn something from them also. But I think there are three themes that come out from this that I see, and partly related also, that you all in different ways contribute to. That's to our understanding of inclusive versus extractive development. In other words, how large parts, the extent to which large parts of the population can be included in, contribute to, and benefit from a process of economic growth, particularly in agriculture, on which a majority of the poor, at least in sub-Saharan Africa, depend. And this is highly relevant because the lack of inclusive growth remains a central problem in least developed countries, at least. Notably, the role of factor endowments and their interactions with local institutions, and more specifically, the low land-labor ratios are a problem, possibly a growing problem in sub-Saharan Africa, and that is a great concern. This also means that this research contributes to our understanding of agricultural development and transformation, and the role that agriculture may play or plays in initiating a process of broader and more sustainable structural transformation and economic development, which is vital for the diversification of employment opportunities and income that you talk about. As well as for access of off-farm wage labor. And then finally, I think that the perhaps most obvious common theme here is your contribution to our understanding of the role and change of institutions in these different processes that we have been talking about. I won't go through them all. And there, I think, we can continue from there. Yes. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Gun. So I think your comments very much echoes some of the questions I had in my mind. Magnus, I'll give you an opportunity to give your comments and questions, and then we'll have a round with the presenters to elaborate on some of the themes.
Thank you, and I hope also will be time for the audience to make questions and comments. I would like to share a few reflections on each of the contributions here, starting first with Arvid. So comment on terminology in regards to victim groups, helping decisions, and charitable organizations. I think this is highly relevant when you work with charities and you have individual decisions. However, what we represent here with Forum Sida and Sida, we work with, it's rights-based. So we work with rights holders and duty bearers, and I think that's very important to keep those apart when we discuss what basis decisions are made. As Arvid said, individual-based decisions, when to give or not, I think that was the key message. I would encourage to make further research on decisions made by Forum Sida and Sida, for example, and they are collective in their nature, as Arvin mentioned. They are usually grounded within a strategy, a Swedish government strategy, or within the Agenda 2030, or previous with the MDGs. So usually linked to some kind of overall document strategy. And of course, we are individuals that take these decisions within a collective structure. And I think that could be a very interesting area to make further research in. That combination when you have individual motivations, as Gun said, but it's done within a collective structure and a setting. So I think that was that's very interesting to also connect this, the rule book, the head, and the heart, to also collective decisions. In regards to Elin's study, I think it reinforces the need to provide girls with education. This is just another argument that Elin presented in part of her thesis. I would like to add that always to make a power analysis to find out the reasons behind why girls are not provided education, which could be either for financial reasons, the families cannot afford it, or it's preferred to have a boy to be provided education. Then we have a gender issue. It could be a security issue for girls. They're not allowed to go to schools, like in Afghanistan, for example. And there could be a number of other reasons to make that a power analysis in regards to find out the reasons for girls being denied education. In regards to Montserrat's thesis, I also thought that was very intriguing and very interesting. And I've been working in Vietnam, both in the north and the south, so for me it was very interesting to hear about this. I agree that agriculture production is one very important driver for development. And I think colonial historical perspectives has its place to explain why they look different in the Red River and the Mekong River. But it goes also to, I think, combine that to see the importance for farmers to have access to land titles, the legal access to land. And I know Sweden had a big project in the mid-90s with Swedesurvey providing legal titles to farmers in the north, which created the possibility to have access to credits. And the private sector was also open up, the private market was open up in Vietnam at that time. It generated a profound change within the production. So I think combining these would be very, very interesting. And also finally, in regards to your research, to look at the climate and to look at the different characteristics of these rivers and the deltas, because they are very different, on how you can have three harvests in the south and you can have two in the north, for example. Yeah? So to add that into the research, I think that would be very beneficial. And then finally to Yumiko, in regards to advocacy, I think it's very, very important to look at these, what we would call, I'm an anthropologist, the elastic structures that could be either the Theravada Buddhism, the hierarchies. You have very strong Confucian traditions within this region as well, and it's very similar to have in regards to your age, if you're male, and your position in society, and that you need to analyze that when you are planning to do an advocacy strategy. But really, these are very basic things in regards to advocacy. You have to ask yourself, why should I do it, and how should I do it? And when you ask how, I think we have examples from Sudan and Cambodia. You can actually use international actors to influence national governments or even local governments when you cannot access through your local CSO partners. So I think and also to make this risk analysis for your organization or for your own person, what can you challenge these either formal or informal powers? And I think we should also, think about what we do have in Sweden in regards to advocacy. We have a very strong tendency to, we would like to agree and we would like to compromise here. So we also need to take that into account when we do advocacy in Sweden. On how to do it. So I will finish here and invite also the authors and also the audience, of course, to make now comments and questions. So thank you.
So maybe just give the word to the presenters. Yes, thank you. And then why don't you prepare your answers meanwhile, and then we can continue the discussion. So who would you like to start?
Okay. Thank you very much for the comments, and I have to say I agree with both comments. I think you spotted what I believe to be benefits and what I believe to be limitations of the kind of research I do in this setting. And about, actually, that's also part of the research. Now we spoke about decisions taken by the heart, by the head, and by the rule book. And of course, different charity appeals or different appeals to the public can be framed to focus more on the emotional, the more rational, calculative parts and the responsibility parts. And that is, I would say, to some extent, ongoing research, at least on the individual level. I also believe that in some like organizations, there are existing norms, there are existing guidelines in how decisions should be made. And I think you mentioned that it's very much from the origin from rights. And of course, if there is a norm that, okay, we should focus first and foremost on rights of the who have the right to receive help and who does not have, that will probably influence how the group will make decisions. I also noticed that when reading Biston's analysis made by EBA, it's a lot of, when evaluating how good a product is, you are focusing on the outcome and efficiency. And I also think that, yeah, if that is the norm that we should maximize efficiency, of course, that influences your decision. However, I think that even when you have an explicit aim that this is how we should make decisions, I think still the other factors can influence, at least to some extent. Finally, I agree totally that, of course, my kind of the research we have done so far is mostly on the individual level. On the collective level, it comes a lot of different social psychology perspectives in that groups make decisions in a different way. So I agree with that, for sure. And I think it would be a fruitful path for future research.
Yes, thank you. I think, just as a suggestion, you could also look at CEDA's website and see how results from Swedish Development Corporation is presented. And I think actually it follows very much, is very much in line with what you presented today. Elin, would you like?
So thank you very much for your comments. I totally agree. And I think that the common theme maybe was education and education of girls. And I think that what's kind of interesting is that if we look at Kenya in total, and especially when we look at primary education, we see that girls are almost as likely as boys to be in school. However, when we kind of dig into these different ethnolinguistic groups, we see that in some groups, I mean, it's a huge difference. And I totally agree that from what we've been doing, we cannot really say that much as to why. And I think that, I mean, that's basically a suggestion for previous or for coming research, that we need to understand, like, why are the girls in these specific groups, why does they have such a smaller probability to be in school than other girls? But, I think that's my main comment. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ellie. I think you're also suggesting, as a policy recommendation, that there be sort of cash transfers as an incentive. I've recently read a book by the journalist Nina Munk, which is about the idealist, about Jeffrey Sachs and his Millennium Village. And actually, there was reported from one village in Kenya where they got school attendance that was increased dramatically by having a school feeding program. Mm. And they also had teachers following nomadic groups to accompany them. And of course, when the project fell apart, I suspect that some of those measures also went down the drain. But in fact, I think that you can look at the problem as incentivized from a demand perspective or from a supply perspective. If you make sort of school available rather than trying to compensate for the economic loss, to sort of change the cost benefit analysis of the particular household. So I mean, I think that the different perspectives that you can use when you start to look at these findings from a policy perspective. Okay, so Montserrat, you.
Thanks. Thank you both for the comments. I'm completely aware that it's extremely theoretical work. I think the approach to that, it was not so how you started. I mean, the idea was really to look at the two deltas today, no? And I think the proposal of the research was like, okay, let's look more immediately, you know, what kind of policies have been implemented and so on. And it quickly showed that it was not sufficient, right? That there was something there behind. And then I got very embedded in the literature of Engelmann, Sokolov, and Zimoglon Johnson, so and Robinson, and it has been driven to pretty much that and how we understand the mechanism. So I think I have to say your summary or your understanding of what the argument is completely right, and is this complex interaction between how that, you know, of course we seek for this exogenous shock, but it's very problematic because processes over time are endogenous, and you know, how do you understand, how do you embrace endogeneity without becoming a tautology, right? So I try to say, okay, well, I still have this factor endowments point of view, you know, and it's the frontier economies versus a very densely populated area, and what kind of institutions are also in place when, you know, the state was in Hue and you know, you still have the local who will determine, you know, if you go to northern Vietnam, you will have these bamboo fences, you know, like the closed village, literally, right? But you have seasonal migration and you have a completely different how, you know, this very interesting transformation. So that's what I thought, that's a valid argument. And then that interaction between the capacity of the village economy to produce surplus and how the surplus is distributed and how people have the incentives. So of course, now I hope next year with more time to start taking it more for the implications, right? So I can process it in a way that doesn't become so theoretical in the writing, and it can become, yeah, more readable. I mean, I come also from a background of I believe it should be that. No, we shouldn't just sit in the ivory tower, but. It's you know, to still keep the richness of the there's complex, but make it less why is taking so many pages to get there. So I'm aware. So I really wish I really plan, and I would like to have the opportunity to take it. And because I think, as you pointed out, the Red River Delta is also, I mean, because as I argue, it's not so much that you have a frontier, you know, there's plenty of land in sub-Saharan Africa, but arable land is not so much. So easily you fall into these situations that you can see in the Red River Delta, you start fragmenting land, especially if you don't put restrictions, you know, or hereditary practices. And the dynamics that we see in that in the Northern Delta could be easily found in other areas with difficulties. So my intention is that I think we could take this case and make it, you know, maybe that reform will not work. And that relates to your comment on the land titles. I mean, Vietnam is the most ambitious land title reform ever. It was 11 million titles issued. And it was complicated. I mean, it was different. The process was very similar in north and south, but the problem was from within, you know, the cumbersome provinces in the frontier of the Mekong. Of course, who owned the land before? There was displacements. There was the land to the tiller reform in 71. They were breaking down the inequalities in land distribution. Did that matter? I mean, it's very hard to statistically prove. That's why the paper is very argumentative, but I gather all the evidence that there was to try to see it. Interestingly, you bring the different climate. The North River, the Red River Delta in colonial times was the most intense area in the world, even more. It was almost close to Japan. But they cannot, they're really reaching the frontier constantly. You know, we see that problem that they doesn't go further. While the South has managed to go from one crop to three crops. So it's like, of course, climate has to allow it, but there's incentives for intensification, and the Northern has incentives, but they really fully can't. And the land, as Ravalion says, they have the land, they have titles, they can create credits, but there's a lot of difficulties of trade. The market is not functionally in the location in the North. Well, in the South it is. So why is that, right? So that's what I mean. It's not saying that it doesn't matter. It's just that, you know, and then, of course, how to present this without writing the 30... I mean, that's... So I'm really looking forward to any comments on this, because I would like to go forward with this, but without... Yeah, anyway, thank you very much.
Yumiko?
Okay. Thank you very much for the comments. I think both commentators are very interesting and useful comments, and I was particularly interested to... I didn't think about this psychological... combining with the psychological aspect into my this kind of research, but now I got some idea for some interdisciplinary research. And also your comment about the use of the international NGOs is important. Actually, I couldn't get to speak, but in one of the chapters of my book, I do talk about this aspect. And it's interesting that these two NGO networks I've looked at, both are actually at the initial phase has been supported by the international NGOs, and they really sort of supported the establishment phase, and they still do engage very closely with international NGOs, but the way they engage is slightly different. So that also has to do with some of the nature of the work. They engage initially in the Cambodia. They are very much started with working with the transboundary river between the Vietnamese and Cambodia, and in a tributary of the Mekong. They were having a major health impact that actually has affected from the dam that's built in the Vietnam. So from the beginning, the network has worked very much with the international issues, and they got a lot of support from international NGO, which was very important. Whereas for Vietnamese network, they mostly work on the domestic issues of the river, and the Mekong was actually their first international rivers to work with. So they actually, although initially they got support from international NGOs, and they still do get the most financial support from them, they actually have more kind of independent view on taking on the advice from international actors. So it was quite an interesting comparison to look at the nature of these networks.
Oh, that's fascinating indeed, and I think very useful.